Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, November 9th, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call, as today we discuss the upcoming oral arguments in the Oil States versus Greens Energy Group case, the Patent Trial Advisory Board case. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and General Counsel, Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome two experts to our call today. We're going to hear from each of them opening remarks of 10 to 15 minutes. We welcome John Thorne. He's a partner at Kellogg Hansen, and Professor Richard Epstein. He's the Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of Law and the Director of the Classical Liberal Institute at the New York University School of Law. As I mentioned, 10 to 15 minutes for opening remarks, but as always, we'll be looking to the audience for questions, so have those in mind. With that, Professor Epstein, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you very much. This case, I think, is going to be one of the landmark cases of this particular term. It's a matter which is of great interest to lawyers, has less obvious salience with respect to the public at large, but one ought not to be misled by that. The issue here involves the relationship of the common law on the one hand to the powers of the administrative state on the other hand. For many, many years, it turned out that patent disputes were tried in ordinary Article III courts. Those are courts which have lifetime judges who are protected so long as they serve in good behavior, in the same fashion as any other case. And under the American Invents Act, which took place, it was passed in 2011, the situation was changed. And what happened is a system of inter partes review, that is, review between the two parties, was established under the Act. And in the Oil States case, it was applied in the following way. Oil States sues for patent infringement against a green energy company, and the case is going on merrily in Article III courts, and then Green decides to bring an action before the PTO, which is supposed to usurp and to trump what is going to happen inside the district court. Both sides understood their forums well. This is not a case about the merits, but it's quite clear that Oil States was, I think, either won or winning in the court above, in the district court, and when it got into the administrative body, all the procedural objections were raised. But nonetheless, the court heard the entire case. I think it's important to note the way in which these panels are constructed, because this does influence things. The head of the USPTO has the power to name as many or as few judges she wants to this particular panel and can supplement that judge as the case goes along in order to serve what they call a uniform policy. But the issue in this case mainly is, what do we understand about the common law and how does it relate to the administrative state? And essentially, the position that has been taken by Oil States in this particular case is that if you start to look at these patents, actions that are brought for patent infringement, actions that are brought for patent infringement seeking damages, are in fact the kinds of cases that the Constitution requires that one set into federal court in an Article III court. The argument on the other side is essentially one which says that so long as the government is in a position to create the right that has been involved by statute, one cannot treat this as though it is a common law action. The courts can, in fact, be ousted by the Congress, given that it has plenary control over the way in which these cases are done. To my mind, one of the essential features in this particular case is the application of the doctrine of unconstitutional conditions. The way in which this case has been set up by the defenders of the particular statute is that if Congress has the power to define the substantive right, Congress has the power to define the forum in which it would be litigated. And if that position is in effect taken, one of the difficulties, I think, with that side of the argument is that it cannot identify any limiting principle whereby the Congress, whenever it creates a new law, cannot remit it to an executive agency. So if you look at Article III, it says the judicial power shall extend to all cases in law and equity that arise under the Constitution and the laws and the treaties of the United States. Virtually any case which has a statutory origin is in fact going to be treated as if it did arise under the laws. And so essentially what happens is anything that arises under the law, which would normally go into Article III, can be taken out. This is a very broad claim, and so the question is, how can this thing be sustained? in my view, is it cannot. The basic principle here, I think, is that the structural limitations on the Constitution are designed to preserve important values of separation of powers. Congress cannot decide to usurp the courts in the way in which it does its business any more than the courts can decide to usurp the Congress. The fact that these things are created by legislation seems to my mind to be utterly immaterial to the underlying question. The issue is, under these circumstances, if you have the kind of action which was thought to be one at common law, then in effect what happens is they have to go into an Article III court. If there are objections to the efficiencies of that particular system, the remedy is not to take these cases out of Article III courts, but it's to reform their civil procedures in a way that make them more responsive. Now, why is it that I come to this particular conclusion? Well, it turns out that if you look at this, there is a countervailing doctrine which talks about the creation of public rights under grants from the government, and those things, starting with a case called Murray's Lessee, could in fact be brought in an Article I court, a tribunal, as it were, set up outside the Article III protections. And we have such courts. The bankruptcy court is a tax court, are both illustrations of those kinds of courts. But the question then is, what counts as a public right? And if, in fact, what you do is you take the position that green energy is putting forward, and the government is putting forward in this case, any time you create a statute, what you have done is to create a public right, which means, in effect, that all statutory causes of action go there. Now, people tried to say, well, we really don't go that particular far. If there is an origin, for example, in the common law for the kind of action that you're having, then if you introduce a statute, that does not make this a subject matter for an Article I court. So one of the situations we have is there were certainly common law rights of actions with respect to trademarks. The statutes come along and they strengthen the particular protection. And it seems to be conceded by the government in these circumstances that you can't take these trademark cases and bring them in to the Article I courts. But under the theory that we're talking about here, it's very hard to see why. Nobody here is suing on the common law action. So if the theory that's being proposed is, in fact, that all statutory causes of action have to be treated as Article I cases, then the answer should be, if you want to go into federal court, just use your weaker common law rights. But if you want to come into a statutory case under the Lanham Act or some other statute, then you could be remitted to Article I. Nobody has claimed that, but it's extremely difficult to explain why it is that that position turns out to be wrong, unless you can think of the way in which the structural constraints work. The point here, I think, is strengthened if we start to then look at it in two ways. One is there's a recent case called Tam against Mattel, and there are a bunch of earlier cases which essentially say that when you're talking about the status of patents and copyrights and so forth, what you do is you don't distinguish them in terms of their constitutional protection from various things associated, for example, with land. So if you're talking about land, it turns out there's a lot of literature which says that you get recordation statutes, and the question would be, if Congress decided with a federal claim to have a certain recordation statute, would that be in and of itself sufficient to say that these things have to be litigated in Article I courts? I think the clear answer to that question is no. So what are the things that count as public rights if they're not all cases? And I think the first class of cases is situations in which there are land grants that have been given by the United States, and there's some kind of disagreement with respect to the status of the title. And if you go back, for example, to a Murray's Lessee case, it turns out that if there's a dispute between a tax collector and the United States, and you're trying to figure out how you balance the accounts, that would be regarded as a public right, and so that you could also litigate that in some informal administrative procedure. There's also cases under the rent control law, which says if there's some kind of a dispute over how much rent is or not owing under a federal statute, you can do that in an Article I court. But it doesn't go much further than that. So, for example, I think it's clearly the case that the mere fact that you can record a title with respect to land under no circumstances makes land disputes between two private parties a subject of public right. Essentially, what happens is the recordation stabilizes the common law situation. Well, somebody says, well, this doesn't quite cover what the patent case is about. And the reason why it doesn't cover that is that the patent case, in fact, involves a situation where you cannot have a patent right unless you have some kind of a statute. But if one goes back very early on, what you discover is that when one talks about the common law, you're not talking about it in a highly literal sense. What happens is, for example, to quote the decision of the United States Supreme Court in the Markman case, is that when you're talking about common law actions for jury trial purposes under the Seventh Amendment, what you're talking about are actions that are analogous to those which were available at common law. And the analogies in this case are extraordinarily strong. What you do is you have a system for the common law actions for damages to real estate. If you invade the particular space, you can be subject to a damage action at common law, and you can be subject to an injunction in the courts of equity. A patent essentially creates a boundary around an invention. The reason why there are no common law patents is not because they weren't thought of in some sense as natural rights stemming from the labor of individuals. It was exactly that impulse which gave them the statutory protection. But rather, what happened under these circumstances is there's no way through a system of meets and bounds that private parties could establish their boundary lines, so you need to have the state come in and impose that. But going back as far as the statute of monopolies in 1623, these things were to be treated always as if they were actions at common law, and the analogies, it seemed to me, to be extraordinarily close. And so once you understand the particular pattern and you start looking at the various cases, what you see in the later Supreme Court situations is a serious awareness of the fact that even when you try to bring cases into the bankruptcy courts, for example, that sometimes if you have a common law action that arises in bankruptcy, a particular party, as recently happened in the case of Stern against Marshall, is going to be forced to remit themselves and to make their way into federal court under an Article III in order to handle this situation. And this makes perfectly good sense. Essentially, what happens is if you have a cleanup of various open accounts between two parties under a statute, you can litigate those in an informal fashion inside an Article I court. But to the extent that you have serious common law rights, i.e. rights to get damages for an infringement of a major piece of property, then in effect the stakes are very, very much larger. And what's so clear about this is if one goes back historically, there's never been an attempt that I'm aware of until this particular time to take an entire branch of substantive law and to treat that particular branch as though it is capable of a Article I court jurisdiction. There are people who will say, well, look, the common law only applies when you're dealing with things that are called natural rights, and everybody recognizes that patents are not natural rights. But it's interesting, if you look at some of the cases that try to figure out what the definition of a natural right is, it turns out that it's very narrow. So the right of inheritance is not a natural right. The right to acquire land is not a natural right. The right to transfer land is not a natural right under cases. So the question of whether or not these things are or are not natural rights, I think, is really quite beside the point. The key question that one has to answer is as follows. If you're dealing with a damage action in something which is an analogous action to a common law action for trespass, you've got to go into federal court and you get a jury trial. If you want to bring a situation where you get an injunction, then you don't need a jury trial because these are actions in equity, but you nonetheless have to go into federal court. So I think that the lower courts on this thing essentially have been mistaken on it. There's no lower court opinion in the oil states case to talk about, and the one that the Judge Dyke wrote in the MCM portfolio case, I think if you go through all of the analogies, each and every case that he cites, when you fully understand it, turns out to be incorrect. So my hope is that the Supreme Court under these circumstances will make sure that you don't allow the administrative state to swamp all of the kinds of common law rights that we have, because if you can do this for patents, you can do it for copyrights, you can do it for trademarks, you can do it for land, and essentially the effort to try to keep the boundary line between private rights and the administrative states will completely fail if it turns out the Supreme Court upholds this particular decision. And with that, John, I pass the baton on to you.
Richard, thank you. This is John Thorne, and first of all, I'm a big fan of Richard Epstein. I've known him for maybe 2.5 decades, and I'm a big fan. So I'm in admiration of the ambitious agenda here of oil states. A quick disclosure. With a couple of my colleagues, Dan Guarnera and Greg Rapaway, we filed a brief in the case, an amicus brief for the auto manufacturers. And our brief said if you want to fix administrative law more broadly, this patent context is not the right vehicle. That's a car joke. But I'm not speaking for the automakers here, just my own views. For those who are not aware of what inter-parties review is, it's an opportunity for the Patent Office to correct its own mistakes. The Patent Office has struggled some in recent times to consistently apply the statutory requirements for getting a patent, the requirement that a patent be novel and non-obvious and cover only patentable subject matter and be useful. There are enormous resource constraints on the patent examiners. Something now north of 650,000 patent applications are filed every year. And Tuesdays are the days when the Patent Office issues patents. So every Tuesday, there's another roughly 6,000 patents that comes out of the office. And especially with the rapidly evolving technology that they deal with, the changes in the law. For example, the Supreme Court's decision in Mayo and Bilski and Alice on what counts as patentable. There's the opportunity that's actually occurs that the Patent Office will issue some patents in error. So a recent example is the Patent Office had issued a patent covering podcasting. I'm not quite old enough to remember this, but I'm told the Lone Ranger radio show started in 1933, and it came out in serial episodes. That same technology on the internet was awarded a patent, and the Patent Office, using this IPR, this inter-parties review process, properly canceled that patent as not a new invention. There's an article that has just come out in the last few weeks in a publication called Science Direct that concludes weather is affecting patent issuance. They did a study of 8.8 million Patent Office decisions between 2001 and 2014 and found that there's a statistically important correlation with temperature. So if it's warm outside, there's a higher allowance rate and a lower final rejection rate.
Great.
Now, if only for the weather effect, it's useful to have the Patent Office revisiting a small fraction of its prior grants. The people that use the IPR process find it deficient, and the judges that are appointed by the Patent Office are good at this. It's actually a fairly small number of patents at issue. I would describe it as using a scalpel in excising a small number of bad patents. So over 99.8% of all active patents never face an IPR, and 82% of litigated patents never face an IPR. And the Patent Office, presented with an IPR petition, is only instituting about 47% of the challenged claims, and they're only invalidating about 24% of the challenged claims. And if you look at the appeal record from these decisions, the Federal Circuit, no patent is canceled until the Federal Circuit approves it if there's an appeal. The appeal record is much higher than the district court claim interpretation decisions. So is this letting the Patent Office correct its own mistakes? Is that valid under the Constitution? The Supreme Court has never held in any case that an executive agency's adjudicative procedures unlawfully usurped the power vested in Article III courts. This is not an exercise of judicial power. Richard mentioned the Stern against Marshall decision by Chief Justice Roberts, which was joined by all the Republican appointees on the court, that said the prototypical exercise of judicial power involves the entry of a decision by a court on a common law cause of action. And there is no common law right to a patent, as Richard mentioned. Patents are a creature of statute. Congress didn't have to allow patents to be issued in the first place. On the question of whether patents are public rights or private rights, I would stand with Justice Thomas in his decision in Teva against Sandoz, 2015. He was joined by Justice Alito. In Justice Thomas's description of the legal status of patents, I'll quote just a little bit from Justice Thomas's opinion. The Anglo-American legal tradition has long distinguished between core private rights and other types of rights. These other rights fall into two categories: public rights belonging to the people at large, and privileges or franchises, which public authorities have created purely for reasons of public policy and have no counterpart in the Lockean state of nature. The English common law placed patents squarely in the final category as franchises that depend upon express legislation. Even under the regime that Parliament put in place through the statute of monopolies, patents remained sovereign grants issued enforced, and revoked by the Privy Council. The framers adopted a similar scheme. That's the end of the quote. Copyrights and trademarks were historically different. Copyrights and trademarks were recognized at common law. And the courts early on in 1834 in Wheaton against Peters distinguished copyrights from patents. The court there said it's never been pretended by anyone in this country or in England that an inventor has a perpetual right at common law to sell what's invented. You go back to some of the framing documents. James Madison in Federalist 43 recognizes that copyrights had long been recognized as a common law right in England, but expressly distinguished that from patent rights. Thomas Jefferson's early letters, if nature has made any one thing less susceptible than all others of exclusive property, it's the action of the thinking power called an idea. Inventions cannot in nature be a subject of property. But two quick points, and then I'll let folks ask questions. The first one is, if not this case, there is a really interesting constitutional question about whether the administrative state has grown bigger than its constitutional moorings. One of the leaders of thinking about whether administrative law is properly law is Philip Hamburger, for example. So in his treatise, Is Administrative Law Lawful?, he talks about not so much the revoking of patents that shouldn't have issued, but the initial issuance of patents. And he describes that if you allow the patent office to issue a patent on something that's already out there, something that people are already doing, so it's not the first invention, it's not novel, or if you allow a patent on something that's obvious, you're going to be impinging on existing property and contract rights. Richard, your paper in
the new reply, yes.
Yes,
the new
property. No new property is the title in the Brooklyn Law Review, is correct. You write that when you create new property rights, the state necessarily limits the common law liberty or property rights of other citizens. For conduct which was once legal now becomes an invasion or an infringement of a new set of rights that have been established. You point out the creation of patents is in derogation of common law rights of property and labor. So Jefferson, in talking about this not being a natural right, in fact Jefferson says this is it's an embarrassment. It's the fine balance between which things are worth the embarrassment of granting a monopoly. Hamburger's idea that issue something that reads on existing businesses without notice, and these are ex parte patent grants, deprives them of property rights. Your idea, new property, is always likely to run into existing businesses. I take those ideas as serious limits, and the question then is, should the administrative agency be allowed to correct its mistake to better obey the Constitution, to not impinge on prior art or things that are obvious that belong to the public?
Can I defend myself on the new property since I wrote the damn article?
Sure. No, please.
Let me just sort of mention something. The actual quotation had to do with the very complicated arrangement under Goldberg and Kelly, where the question is whether or not you wanted to give people a right to a hearing before their welfare rights were terminated. And on the particular case, what I noted from Jerry Mashaw is every time you keep somebody inside the system by not allowing them to be forced out by the government, then somebody else is kept out. And that was the correlative duty. And the question there was actually quite narrow, which is whether you got a hearing prior to termination or whether after termination you had some right to go elsewhere. On the other point, if you go back, you don't have to go back to Jefferson. You could go back to Proudhon. And what he did is he said every time you create property rights in land, what you necessarily do is to limit the freedom of motion of other individuals to go where previously they have gone because the land has been taken out of the commons and put to private use. So the question is then, what's the justification for that? And I wrote another paper, which was not quoted by John, in the San Diego Law Review, which essentially makes the kind of point he's doing, say, the reason we do this is behind a veil of ignorance. We think that if we start having private property rights in land, but not in water for a variety of technical reasons, it's going to be a Pareto improvement so that everybody will be better off having lost the particular rights of entry to gain the rights of productivity, which will produce goods and services that can be traded. It's exactly the same trade that you're making with intellectual property. At the core of intellectual property, there is a center known as the body of ideas and natural formulas and so forth. And everybody regards these things are not patent eligible. They can't be covered by copyright, trademark, or anything else. But for everything else that was in this particular commons, the logic is that what you do is you privatize the particular rights, and thereby what you do is you get an incentive to create things, and when people start to trade private rights, they're going to be better off as a group than they were if it's in common. So the point about this argument, which Sean says is right, is it's exactly the same argument for land as it is with respect to patents. The creation of private rights is a Pareto improvement over the world in which everything is in common. And if that turns out to be the case, it just simply reinforces the point that the logic of intellectual property and the logic of physical property turn out to be identical, which is why the common law actions were always analogous, which is why it is in cases like Markman and so forth, when they defend the use of the jury, it's not just for common law rights, it's for analogous rights. And essentially the question is whether you want to truncate this thing so as to get rid of the analogous rights. And it seems to me that would be a mistake. There are many things that are wrong with the judicial decisions. There are many things that are wrong with the panels. The way in which you handle the patent office question, in my judgment, is you take the revenues generated by the patent office and spend it on the patent office. And the way in which you enforce the courts or improve the courts is to make sure you rationalize the rules of civil procedure. But I don't think there's any reason in any of these administrative problems to alter the balance between things that are commonly called common law rights, even if created by statutes or not. And the key point here is that the state may create the patent by giving you the grant, but it's not as though it previously had a patent on that thing which it gave to you. It's the private generation in a decentralized market which makes patents completely different from public lands.
Yeah, well, Richard, I agree with some of what you say. If a patent is granted on something that's new and it's properly limited to be a good incentive to creating creating new things and it's not overbroad, that's a public good and of course Congress gets to make those trade-offs. Academics and practitioners don't do that. If separation of powers means anything, it means we respect what Congress has done here. But the risk that if I trespass on your land, I'll notice it and you'll notice it usually. If I get a patent on something in an ex parte proceeding, but there's somebody that's had a factory running on another part of the country for 10 years, there could be a huge reliance interest built up in existing businesses, and somebody, Columbus discovers America, and I've got a patent that now covers your business, and I'm going to tax it or force you to stop. That's an impingement on existing property and contract rights. And if the patent office discovers it's done that, allowing it to correct its mistake and promptly in an efficient process is a public benefit. So I go back to the text of the Constitution. It gives Congress the power to promote the progress of science and useful arts by granting these exclusive rights and discoveries. And there are kind of two administrative law functions that Congress could use in creating this. One is, given the volume, Congress isn't going to do it itself. They're going to, and they did since the beginning, set up an agency to review these things. Two ways you can do it. One is at the gatekeeping stage, you can have more patent examiners spend more time on each application to be more careful that nothing issues that isn't really novel and unobvious. But there's a separate tool that's well known. It goes back, even the Privy Council did this, it's sort of an exorcism function that lets you expunge the small number of controversial patents that are found after a little bit of experience to be problematic. And if you say that this broad grant of power to Congress to create the system that promotes social good can only have gatekeeping functions but not an exorcist function too, that seems like you're tying Congress's hands in the way that the Constitution didn't.
No, the Constitution does tie it that way when it creates the separation of powers. And remember, the Privy Council was a judicial body. It wasn't an executive body at that particular time. People took appeals to it all the time under these circumstances. And in fact, the Privy Council used to hear cases from Canada and Australia until those guys declared independence under it. The point is,
I thought the Privy Council were advisors appointed by the king.
Well,
They had a judicial function. They were appointed
the Privy Council.
His advisors.
Well, but the Chancellor was his advisor too at one point. And what happens is things start as advisors, and then what they do is they harden into courts. And the way in which it used to work is that if you went there and there was a claim to annul the patent, that would be an equitable form of relief. But if it turned out there was some underlying factual dispute, what they did is they referred it back to a jury for a factual determination. So the actual procedures which have a judicial separation were, in fact, those which were used, which is why in the statute of monopolies they start talking about how these things, in fact, are created in common law. And one other point, John, you're absolutely right that somebody's using an invention of his own, which somebody else doesn't know about. There's always a conflict of interest there, which is why it is that the patent situation is a public body. And the fellow who sees that he's using a technology and thinks it's in common use, what he can do essentially is to go into the court, into the patent office, to try to stop this. And in fact, inter partes review before final issue was common under the 52 Act, and there's nobody who objected to that. But what's going on in this case, which you have to stress, is you're already in the judicial system, and you're doing it, and now I've never seen a case in which an administrative agency can take a case out of a court and decide it as if it were a court of first instance, and it's that which is the problem. And so all efficiency arguments should go to the way you reform the system. It seems to me, actually, I believe this, it's very dangerous to put too much power in the executive branch because it turns over with the political preferences of the president, and it turns out that if you head of the PTO, which is strongly pro-patent, you're going to get one set of judges in one set of situations. You do it the other way, you're going to get another. The advantage of doing this in a federal court system is you get some degree of permanence and independence, and that's exactly why we want to keep the older rules on separation of powers.
Richard, I'm sure I just misunderstood you. I thought you said this took things out of the court. The courts remain available. The courts are always available as a forum for it's an additional venue that allows the same body that granted the patent to look and say, we didn't have this piece of prior art here, and if we'd seen this piece of prior art, we would have recognized you weren't the first to invent this. You don't deserve the patent.
Well, you could say that in court. Do you think in this particular case, after inter partes review, you could go back to district court again? No, it's appellate court. It's the question of you ousting. Basically, what you're doing is you're making the patent body the court of first instance. And everything you say about the substance is surely right. From the beginning of the statutes, prior art was always a perfectly ground, because you don't want to give patents to people which give them monopoly rights when they haven't added anything to the sum of human knowledge. But typically, if you look at the other statutes on trademarks, for example, you get de novo review. I don't believe you get de novo review at first instance under this statute. If you do, then there's no reason.
Trademarks and copyrights are similar to patents in many ways in the Supreme
Court.
But
I know that, but they're also
reminding us of that. But they were recognized at common law. They have a somewhat different status. If I'm reading Justice Thomas and Justice Alito.
Yes, you're right, but you're wrong about, I think, the following thing. Given what you said, if Congress can now create a stronger right in trademarks, under your logic, since there's no doctrine of unconstitutional conditions, it can say if you wish to exercise this stronger right, you have to stay in the administrative body, and you can't go into Article III. You want to go into Article III, you have to stick with your crappy common law rights. And the basic position that you're taking here, which I find so extraordinary, is that any grant of a claim under statute can be done in an Article I court. There's no limiting principle in your brief or anywhere else, and in fact, all the cases that you cite in the brief are dealing with kinds of things which are essentially tangential to the separation of powers issue. So, for example, to take one illustration, it turns out that common law, certain kinds of rights were not assignable in an inchoate fashion. You create a patent system, and what you do is you say that the claim can be assigned prior to the time of its perfection, and what the courts say is, this is not a common law right, so we can do this. That's all fine and dandy, because what's not at stake in that particular issue is the choice of form. It's a choice of rights. But every grant, I've never seen a patent which has been granted in the following form, which is you have a bent over this following situation, and these are the procedures that you must use. And generally speaking, when you're talking about grants, it's only the terms of the grant that get influenced.
In fact, every patent that is still in effect was issued in a regime that said the patent office on its own motion, on the director's own motion, could be canceled if it was anticipated by something else. It wasn't the first, or it was obvious and belonged to the public.
But it was not.
Every patent out there is, for 30-plus years has been subject
they've,
to that.
Oh, you're right, but it's never been the case that the cancellation necessarily takes place in the patent office after issuance. That's why you have these infringement actions. No, this is not a question of whether or not.
In the prior proceedings, the prior proceedings of the patent office, there were ex parte reexamination, which began in 1981, inter partes reexamination, which began in 1999.
The question you have to ask yourself, if we kept with those statutes, you don't need to have the current situation under the AIA. So
this is substantively not different from the prior regime.
It's
resources that match the volume of problematic patents. Again, if you respect separation of powers, you respect Congress's judgment on these policy choices.
No, you don't.
Congress found in 2011 that there were huge numbers of poor quality patents causing gum in the system, and that if they could be dealt with faster, innovators would do more to innovate.
A lot of dispute over those findings, to put it mildly. The question is, Congress could set the substantive standards up. But the system of current law that we have is it sets the standard, the adjudication goes into the courts. And, you know, cases like Horn and Tam essentially make it very clear that there's no differentiation in the class of valid patents from valid copyrights from valid land titles. And what's happening here is the reason why this act is so extraordinary is that what it's doing is it's allowing the ultimate determination of validity in all cases to be made by basically bypassing the federal district courts. But I think you probably want to open it up.
Gentlemen, I think our audience, I would be surprised if they don't have a host of questions by now. We've got a lot on the table. Let's open the floor to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got just one question pending, then our lines are wide open. Star button and then pound button on your telephone. Let's take our first call of the day now.
Hi, this is Ron Katznelson. Thank you for this exposition. Sounds very interesting. I'd like to ask a question for John. You argue that Congress is empowered to create an executive agency tribunal for, quote, correcting the agency's errors. In essence, a do-over. But the do-over wouldn't have existed before 1836. There was no examination, and yet the patent right was there and available. Are you saying, for example, that your argument only works after 1836? That's the first question. Second, upon the issuance of the patent, the inventor must irreversibly disclose the invention in exchange for the exclusive right, a right to which no one had before but for the disclosure. The agency doesn't get to do over that patent bargain. So how does it get to do over only one side of the bargain and not restore the secrecy to the applicants? This doesn't seem right, because this is not a new right or a new property. It is something that is inchoate with the inventor. Inventor has to have possession of that invention. That's part of the patentability requirements under Section 112. So it just doesn't jive the concept of a do-over. Thank you.
Good questions. On the 1836 and how early was the revocation of patents available? The Privy Council in England and other examples are briefed at great length and very good briefs filed by the government and on the pharma side by Jeff Lampkin and the PTAB Bar Association, Josh Siegel. I'd commend you to read their history. But on the second question that you asked, the disclosure risk, patentees don't have to take the risk. Everybody since, not just since 2011, but since 1981, everyone who's asked for a patent has known that if they disclose their invention, they're at risk that the patent office will determine that somebody else invented it first. They'll find prior art, although determine that it's obvious and not worthy of a patent. They will have made the disclosure in that event. Whether that happens before the initial grant or after the initial grant makes less difference. They've accepted a bargain. They've made the disclosure, and if it turns out they're not the first, then the disclosure doesn't matter very much.
But this is not just correcting the error. Maybe the correction is wrong, and I deserve a de novo review of that correction, quote unquote. So, you know, nothing is absolute about the correction. It's just another cut at the apple by the PTAB without any review. So it is a point where the bargain is struck with the expectation that Article III court will adjudicate any dispute, not the
PTAB. Well, Article III court does review every patent off, every PTAB decision under the normal presumption that the agency has done its work correctly. But if you've read the decision, the Federal Circuit, they're fairly thorough, and the PTAB is upheld more than district
courts,
which is a fair
that's
measure.
Yeah, but that's deferential review. That's not de novo. It's a deferential review.
Yes, and that's the point. That's the point, John, that I've been stressing, is the older system is de novo. This is deferential. It's clearly a major transformation. And the question is why these rights are singled out. I still haven't heard a clear answer to the question of why it is that a statutory modification of a common law right does not give Congress, under your theory, the power to keep that inside the PTAB or any other agency. The fact that the common law right existed prior to this doesn't mean that the statutory right did it. And under your theory, there is no creation of any statutory right in any particular context that Congress in its infinite wisdom cannot put into Article I, which means, in effect, that it can negate Article III, and to the extent that judicial power is supposed to be independent as a check on the executive, it's there. I don't care who does or does not like this in terms of particular situations. Obviously, there are huge numbers of people who are on the other side of these things, not trade associations. But the question is, again, quite simply, is do you get a final adjudication in an Article III court on these claims? And under your view, any time there's a federal statute involved, you could oust Article III courts for the primary determination and leave yourself at most with some sort of deferential appellate review. So is it true
Richard, I don't know how to be clearer that there is no common law right to a patent.
No, I understand what you said, but I'm trying to be clear the other way. We take the trademark stuff. There's the Lanham Act, right? Can the Lanham Act basically provide all cases adjudicated under the Lanham Act must go to an Article I court?
So the Congress didn't have to create a patent right, or they could
have. Didn't have to create the Lanham Act.
Congress could have said, we're going to allow patents on molecules because typically a miracle drug involves a lot of research and development, a lot of effort that needs reward and protection. And on the other side, the definition of molecule is narrow, and so the reward is for the exact thing invented, and there's a lot of effort to be protected. They could have said, we're going to patent molecules, but we're not going to patent software because the opposite is true. You've got simple,
no one is agreeing on
things that. So Congress didn't have to create this in the first place, and there was no common law right, and the doctrine
right.
that you're talking about, that this must be done only in courts and that an agency can't fix its own errors, that doesn't apply to things that aren't.
Yes,
aren't
well, again, law. I'm telling you, there is no – the Lanham Act gives you rights that you did not have at common law for trademarks, right? Gives you stronger presumptions, notice validity, and so forth. Can the Congress say when it creates a stronger right in intellectual property and trademarks, they have to be done before an Article I court? And under your theory, it has to be the case because you've not explained in any way, shape, or form why it is that there are some classes of statutory causes of action that must be in Article III and some that cannot. Your theory brings everything into Article I, which is the most massive shift in overall jurisdiction imaginable.
No.
Everybody agrees they don't have
to
create patents.
Public rights.
What? No. A public right, essentially, anything that is created by the government is a public right. If you go back historically and you check what's going on, a public right never included a patent. There's not a single word in any case that anybody has ever cited which treated them as a public right, not for the purpose of statutory creation, but for the purposes of what went on in Murray's Lessee. And I went through all of the cases, and they're all extremely narrow. They have to do essentially with financial adjudications. So you take the Thomas case. It's not as though the agency, when it decides to register a rodenticide or a pesticide, says, oh, you could only dispute that in an Article I court. What it says is there are these collateral battles of using one person's information to decide the validity of another person's thing. They clean up issues in terms of just compensation. That you can administer in an Article I court. The financial windup, not the validity of the patent. So the question still remains. The Lanham Act now gives you stronger rights Can Congress attach to the Lanham Act a proposition which says, if you wish to assert rights and trademarks that are stronger than those available at common law courts, you must go to Article One? Under your theory, that would have to be correct, and yet you keep disclaiming it.
I don't know if that follows. It is an interesting point. What other regimes might be at risk, either
well,
because
any statutory regime. I mean,
For example, I did a case in the Copyright Royalty Board a year ago where three judges, Article One judges, were deciding what's the price of copyrights on the internet. Congress assigned them that function, and the copyright that Congress created was one that didn't involve a common law predecessor.
Well, no, I'm saying, look,
under statutory
modification of a common law right is a statutory right. And under your theory, where Congress, whenever it creates a right, it conditions the formula, it means that every statutory innovation on every subject, whether or not relating to intellectual property, has to be in Article I court. So if you want to go into Article III, you have to use your common law rights. The whole point that's exactly
what
it says.
The patent statute and most of the other statutes that we could talk about, like the copyright one that I started with, all permit Article III adjudication.
Well, I'm saying,
you can bring a patent case in federal court. You can seek to invalidate a patent in federal court. The federal courts are available for that.
But they can always be trumped
in the Article III court.
They can be trumped. The point is, as Ron said, the issue is not whether you get appellate review under a definitional standard. The issue is de novo review.
I take it this is Dean Reuter. We've got three questions pending.
Okay,
I take it if somebody brings an action before PTAB, the patent holder doesn't have the right to immediately remove it to an Article III court.
Yes.
No. There's no right of removal.
Right.
Although there, in some cases, already is an Article III adjudication running in parallel.
Right.
In some cases.
I get that. Okay. Good. Three questions pending. Let's take another call.
Hello, my name is Robert Schmidt. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, we can hear you fine. Go right ahead.
I'm the national chairperson of a group called the Small Business Technology Council, which advocates for 6,000 companies that are inventing companies that do small business innovation research programs. So we produce more patents than all the universities combined, these small companies. First comment is the fact that this act has been so devastating to the companies we represent, which has led to more companies dying than being formed and all the severe impacts that I'm sure you're all familiar with in the economy and the lack of job creation because we're just killing these small businesses. Before I get to my question, I was hoping to be able to hear a little bit more of an answer to Ron Katznelson's question on the disclosure issue of the fact that, so I got a patent, so now it's finally been disclosed, and most of our companies don't do international disclosures because they can't afford the international patents. So this would never have been disclosed before, but now we have a valid patent, and all of a sudden we're finding the PTAB is saying it's not valid, and you've lost your trade secret rights. So I'd like to hear more about that. But my second question is about standing, the fact that anybody can come in and do this versus having the traditional standing. I'd like to hear a little bit more about that. Thank you.
John, you want to go first? I think it's a challenge, Steve.
Richard, I'll start, but then you chime in.
I will certainly do that.
If you believe in separation of powers, then you entrust Congress to make these choices. For example, the Harvard Business Review in 2011, the year the AIA was passed, estimated that patent trolls were costing the U.S. economy $29 billion a year. Congress found that patent trolls were using poor patents to hold companies hostage and demand settlements that were cheaper than the millions it would cost to litigate the case. There was a drain on innovative companies that Congress was trying to address. If your members include the inventor of the podcasting patent, then I'm delighted that some of the patents have been canceled. But the benefit of this found by Congress, if you believe in separation of powers, is hard to challenge. on standing, it's absolutely true that IPRs do not have a standing requirement. In fact, an IPR can go forward even if the original petitioner drops out. It doesn't award damages. There's an ability to amend the patent during IPR, which is different. There's a different burden of proof. There are a lot of differences that make this unlike ordinary litigation, make it much more like the original issuance of a patent by the patent office.
Can I get a response?
I find
yeah, go ahead.
That you're still quoting the $29 billion figure, which has been widely debunked.
Yes, I want to say that is one of the most scandalous studies ever written on the face of the globe. If you want to see this, let's first do it as a matter of theory as to why it is that the patent issue is, I think, completely misunderstands the basic problem. And the simple observation here is anybody who aggregates patents, essentially what they do is they take the claims that they have from the patentee, and they are subject to the defenses available to any potential infringer. So the question then is, what sort of additional rights do they get over other people? They don't get any. And so the question you then have to ask is, why do they do it? Because generally speaking, they're probably more efficient in the way in which they enforce the particular patents in question. And the incentive problem, John, is a two-sided problem. What you're doing is you're stopping certain people from engaging in activities which are infringing, and that means if that's correctly determined, what happens is that you're encouraging inventors who get patents, because their rate of return is going to be secure, against other individuals who don't do it. The Besson and Moyer study was wrong in so many different ways it's hard to recount it, but the one I think that is kind of touching is what you do is you ask the people who have been found guilty of infringement as to whether or not their willingness to innovate has been hurt. And you know what? The answer is yes, to which the answer may well be you are stopping infringers from infringing, so the fact that they are doing less innovation is a good thing rather than a bad thing. And so I think, in effect, one of the things about this is I have no doubt that Congress can make its findings. I actually participated in some of this stuff on the 2011 things with particular reference to the business method patents. And as I wrote in this little column that I did for the Federalist Society actually on this stuff, the whole 2011 statute was an interest faction group nightmare from start to beginning. If you want to see how to draft a good patent statute, go back to 1947, where two guys are working in a kitchen at night, did a better job than did the entire Congress on this. And, John, they're certainly right that they have the power, but the power doesn't give them the wisdom. And the fact that since they don't have wisdom, given the factional politics, having a separate and independent body, the judiciary, is a checker there. And as the questioner said, there is no question that the rate of innovation by small companies in the United States on formation is lower now than it's been for a very, very long time. And the real dangers that you get with the PTO and in generally a slightly hostile atmosphere towards patents around the world is that the real loss comes from the patents that never get filed because people are afraid to make the kinds of inventions in question. And so when you're trying to figure out what the global situation is, if you don't start the new businesses, they will not expand. It's interesting that virtually all the organizations that you cited, John, who are in favor of the particular litigation are large companies who are in defensive postures in a large number of these
cases. So, Richard, if I get awarded, you probably have more to say, and I'm interrupting you. But
that go right ahead.
No, thank you. A policy decision about whether there are too many bad patents, you would agree, is properly assigned to Congress, given what the Constitution says. When the 2011 Act came up for a vote, it passed 95-5 in the Senate. That doesn't sound like any other act in recent memory. It passed by a 3-1 margin in the House. Congress made the policy determination there were too many bad patents dragging the economy down. They found facts that are just different from what you're talking about.
Yeah, but I mean,
patent aggregation, which you brought up, the Federal Trade Commission did a study 2 years ago that found a lot of problems with the way some of the larger aggregators are behaving. This is a very problem. It's a new topic. It's probably worth another podcast, but a very problematic set of behaviors.
It's both ways. You can have dubious questions by innovators. You can have dubious questions by defendants icing cases and so forth. And I have no question that the overall inefficiencies of the system have gotten larger as the patents have become more contentious.
So who decides when?
No, again, this is what happens.
This is not a question of saying
that the statute is unconstitutional because I disagree with its finding. But the question is whether or not the Congress has the power to oust Article III courts from dealing with these disputes is a very different question. And if you believe in separation of powers, it cannot be the decision of one branch of government, Congress, to decide what the scope of the powers of another branch of government is, which is the judiciary. And that's the position that's been taken here. If Congress can create the right, it can oust the court.
We're talking about the very small subset of patents that
doesn't matter.
That are found to have been anticipated by somebody else's works. You've got a guy who's built a factory and he's producing products, and he's told you have to stop doing what you independently developed because somebody after you got a patent granted through the patent.
But that's going to be true in any world. The issue is whether or not you would adjudicate.
Can the patent office fix its error?
Sure. John, no, it's not fixing its error. Congress gets to pass legislation, decide whether or not to keep it, and the courts get to do adjudication, which is the particular dispute in question. And you need an administrative determination because otherwise you can't figure out what the scope of the patent is. But when this thing is going to be challenged, the position is an Article I court is not going to be sufficient. You need the other thing. And there's no question, by the way, that notwithstanding all the stuff that talking about the system, is you can go into an Article III court and you can say that the patent is invalid. You could come in before the thing is filed and be an objector. The issue is once a patent is issued, it's a completed grant. That becomes a judicial function on its adjudication. Before it's issued, it's a legislative function. My quarrel with Congress, I don't think it did a very good job on patents. My quarrel with the courts is I don't think they're doing particularly good jobs with the stuff. eBay case and so forth are a mistake. That's a different discussion. The only discussion here is the question of when Congress decides to make a particular policy judgment as to what kinds of things are going to be given to patents. Can it, after a particular patent is identified, cut the trial courts out from making these adjudications by making essentially the patent office the trial court of first instance? And I think that's unconstitutional.
Well, gentlemen, we've got two questions pending. Let me see if we can slip in both of these questions and then I'll give you the chance to answer whichever or both, if you like. Go ahead, caller.
Hi, thank you guys very much for this discussion. My question is this an issue that needs to be resolved in the AIA, or is this something that needs to be tackled with regards to Chevron deference in the first place?
Okay, let's hold that question, if you could, gentlemen, okay. And we'll take the next caller and see if we can have both questions on the board at once. Go ahead, caller.
I'll try to be very quick. This is Josh Landa from CCIA. I just wanted to make the quick point that the Oil States District Court case is actually still pending while the IPR is resolved.
Yeah.
Separate from that, I wanted to ask, particularly to John, whether the different actual remedies in district court when a court holds a claim invalid, the order is basically that the patentee is no longer allowed to assert that claim. They're stopped from assertion. There's no formal revocation of the patent. In an IPR or a CBM, there's a very different remedy where the director is actually ordered to revoke the patent formally. Does that difference have any sort of influence or any information for us on this question?
I think you've correctly described one of the important differences in the two procedures, and it's an example of how what the patent office is doing is on behalf of the public getting rid of patents that would threaten others besides the ones that happen to be in court.
Yeah, I think again the problem is there are two kinds of error. So if what happens is the PTO invalidates what should be a valid patent, and then it creates all the ripple effects in the opposite direction. So I don't think that one can say that because the PTO the second time gets it right. In some cases, is an argument for the institutional arrangement. Article III courts can get it either right or wrong. And I think the key feature, which is not really talked about as much in this case as it should have been, is I think the mode of selection on an ad hoc basis of which particular panel hears which particular court has much more of a dangerous for buyers than the situation where you get ordinary judges doing this on rotation. And as for the other point, this is not a case about Chevron deference. That's a question of the way in which, when you take ambiguous languages of a statute, how would administrative agencies construe it. Nobody's arguing here about what the language of the particular statutes are. They're arguing on a question where the law is clear as passed, whether or not it's within the scope of Congress to pass it.
So on the first question, I agree with Richard. This particular case doesn't involve Chevron deference, but there is a very interesting and deep problem of the administrative state, and whether the court will begin to curtail the body of administrative law and the administrative agency. That's an interesting project. My point of view is that this is not the vehicle for that, because when the patent office cancels a patent that shouldn't have issued, they've actually done a constitutional plus, not a minus. And so this is just the wrong opportunity. So if I could make a bold prediction, Richard Neal, let you make a prediction. I think the court will affirm the Federal Circuit 9-0, 8-1. Big majority, but they may write something. In fact, if my former colleague Justice Gorsuch writes, they may write something that says the administrative state is a concern. We're not going to apply that concern in this context, but like Marbury against Madison, establish new principles to be applied elsewhere.
Well, I'm not sure how to predict this thing. It's certainly the received wisdom on the part of the patent bar that what Congress wants is a 900-pound gorilla Congress will get. But on the other hand, there are at least two recent Supreme Court cases that point strongly in the opposite directions, which had commanding majorities. There's the Roberts opinion in Horn, which essentially treats patents and land as interchangeable, and so therefore the implication for jurisdiction of the courts and the legislature should be the same. If you cannot, in effect, take a land registration title and use that as a ground to oust an Article III court, why can you do it with a patent? I think becomes a much more close question. And then there's the unanimous decision in TAM, in which when you start dealing with trademarks and so forth, sort of treats trademarks, patents, all this stuff on a parity and ignores all of the distinctions that John tried to make, and given the fact that some of them had a common law origins and others did not. So I don't know exactly what the answer is going to be. It's quite clear which way the businesses line up. I think we've seen this already, is all the small businesses hate the AIA, and all the large businesses tend to like it. And I think the explanation is the large businesses are as much defendants as they are plaintiffs, whereas the small inventors are almost always plaintiffs and never defendants. And that gives you some idea. You can't simply say that when the PTO makes the decision, it's made the right decision. It may well have made the wrong decision. And when you're evaluating institutions, you cannot ignore the sorry reality that there are always two kinds of errors, enforcing patents that ought not to be enforcing, and of equal importance, not enforcing those patents that should be enforced.
Well, gentlemen, I'm afraid... Go ahead. We'll give you the final word.
If I could give Michael McConnell, former 10th Circuit judge and now professor, the last word. I think the first time I met Richard, Professor McConnell was teaching at University of Chicago too. He wrote, "It's entirely consistent with the Constitution for Congress to bring to bear the experience and expertise of the Patent Office in providing more robust review of issued patents. From the beginning, patents have never been regarded as a fully and irrevocably vested right, because a patent is not a natural right, solely a product of positive law."
I wrote an opposition to that.
And
I thought Michael was wrong on every single one of those points. The fact that it is not a natural right, inheritance is not a natural right. You look at this, the class of natural rights turns out to be about empty and zero. And congressional expertise on this subject, I think, given the powers of faction, is always to be suspect. That's why we have division of powers, because we don't want to put all of it in one basket, and that's exactly what's happening if we sustain this statute.
Thank you to the Federal Society for sponsoring this.
Yeah, a great discussion. I want to thank you both on behalf of myself and behalf of the Federalist Society. We certainly appreciate your time. This is a case scheduled for argument November 27th, so not that long in the future. Richard, you mentioned, Professor Epstein, you mentioned something you wrote for us. That's on the Federalist Society's blog for any of you who want to take a look at that. It's a pretty long post, but instructive. I'm sure we'll check back in with both of you after oral arguments to try and get your input on what's transpired.
Well, it will be a very interesting hearing.
Yes, and I want to thank our audience as well for dialing in and for your questions. A reminder to check our website and check your emails for upcoming telephone conference calls. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.